Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Family Business Radio. I am one of your hosts, Pat Rombaletti, president of Sage Executive Search. The other host, Meredith Moore of Moore Wealth Management, is not with us today, so I'm flying solo. She had to be out of town, but she will be back on our next show. And just so you know, our Family Business Radio is here to showcase family businesses. We're here to build a community that is designed to educate and inform and support family-owned businesses. And we'll do that by bringing on family business owners to tell their stories and real-life war stories. We will share the stories of executives that are non-family business owner members who are serving and helping them grow their business. And then we will also be sharing insight from professional advisors that assist those business owners. And my guest today falls into that last category of a trusted advisor to family businesses. So I want you to join me in welcoming our guest today, Sarah Burden.
Welcome. Hi, Pat. Glad to be here.
Thank you. You know, my clients frequently use my executive search services to recruit outside talent when they're about to sell their businesses. So I sought out Sarah in the Atlanta marketplace because I wanted to be sure that I had a highly knowledgeable and experienced resource for my clients. And what I loved about Sarah is her background. She has had real hands-on experience. She has worked as in a corporate environment. She was an entrepreneur and business owner. And in that role, she actually acquired a company and divested her company. And so for the past 19 years, she's been putting all of that experience to work for her clients in her role of VP of Walden Business. So, Sarah, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about Walden Business?
Walden Businesses is a small to middle market M&A firm, and we tend to specialize in distribution, light manufacturing, and B2B service companies. We actually, on our websites, have two different segments. One is the smaller market group that showcases our clients that are $1 million in value and below. And then the Walden Bus website features clients that are above $1 million in value.
Excellent. Good way to segment out. Very different needs in those two categories.
Absolutely.
That's great. That's great. So, you know, Sarah, last week our guest was John Dillard, CPA, and he really talked about the importance of making sure that you have a current valuation for your business. And I know that is something that you are very involved in at Walden. And I know that in addition to being a frequent guest speaker and panelist on the topic of the show today, you were also recently recognized as one of less than 100 professionals in the United States who have earned the Merger and Acquisition Master Intermediary designation. Can you tell us a little bit about that designation, that distinction?
Well, it's a very new designation, and to your point, I understand that there are actually 74 of us in the country. So,
wow.
And it's a certification that came about through many years of work in the industry. We were required to have completed X number of transactions at a value of $1 million or above, excluding real estate. We're required to have a certified business intermediary designation, which I also have. And then you also have to have a number of years experience in the industry. Not to mention hours and hours and hours of class time. So it took a while to get there. I'm very proud of it, and I'm proud to be among those 74 individuals across the country who have it.
You should be proud of it, and your clients should feel safe in your arms because that is the experience and having seen all of the different things is just got to be invaluable. So congratulations on
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I think before we get into the meat of the topic today, which is, gosh, I thought my business was worth so much more, but more importantly, how to make sure that it is, I wonder if you could share what's probably on the minds of many of our listeners is what's going on out there in the marketplace today? Things are not business as usual. What are you seeing in your M&A work?
I would say that the most positive thing that I'm seeing today since the first of the year is actually about the middle of January. I have seen more activity. Last year, we had almost a paranoia state with both buyers and sellers. Sellers were afraid to sell. Buyers were afraid to make the commitment to buy. And certainly, the banks were not cooperating with us at all. In fact, I had dinner last evening with a former client who has now become a great friend, and her transaction was completed in August of 2008. That was the last traditional bank transaction that I've done. All the closings since that date have been non-traditional funding. And about 2 weeks ago, in our office, we did have another closing with one of the other brokers who did have a traditional bank-funded deal. So that, along with the fact that we are seeing tremendous buyer activity, the equity markets are coming back, the strategic players are becoming more active, and certainly the sellers are beginning to feel like, okay, I've got that year behind me. Mm. I'm ready to move forward. I'm ready to get on with my life. And it's a good feeling. It's like, okay, we're finally done with it.
Yeah, it sounds like much better news. It sounds like it's not completely over, but
thawed. It's not over, but yeah. But the thaw has begun.
That's excellent. Thanks for that insight, and mm-hmm. I'm sure our listeners will be pleased to hear that things are a little bit better. You know, from the very moment that you and I first talked, you shared a very revolutionary idea of when to start planning an exit. Kind of counterintuitive to what I know anybody has ever voiced to me as I've talked to them. Can you tell our audience what it is, that little secret that you shared with me?
Well, I'm not sure it's a secret. Many of us have known about it for a long time, but putting it into action is a different story. And that is, when a person starts a business, when they get started from the very beginning, they should plan that business as if they're going to sell it. They should work it. They should hire. They should strategize. Everything about the business should be calculated on the basis of, I'm going to sell the business one day. So you really start your exit the day you open the doors.
Wow. So let's go a little bit, you know, I'm sure our listeners are saying, well, wait a minute, I did just open my doors some, and I'm so excited, and I'm working on my marketing, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that, and now you're telling me I also have to be planning my exit. So in those early stages, I'm sure it looks much different than the things that we'll cover later on in the topic, but you highlighted a couple of things there. What does that look like in those early months of saying, you open your business today and immediately start that process of selling?
Well, as you can imagine, over the past 19 years, we have seen a lot of different pictures of sellers and a lot of different states of condition in the businesses that they own. And some are very sad. Some are very, very prime for having the best value possible placed on them. And what we look for and what a buyer is going to look for and what we try to encourage people who are starting their own companies and certainly those who are thinking about an exit strategy 2 or 3 years out when they have the time to be able to make the corrections, we start with the accounting, setting up good accounting systems. And one of the pitfalls that we've seen over the last few years with QuickBooks, which is a very easy program to use. A lot of accounting firms use it, but unfortunately, it allows you to have a cash-based balance sheet and an accrual-based P&L or vice versa. And obviously, those two have to match. You either do one or the other, but not a commingling of the two because it just totally distorts the accounting picture. So hire a good CPA. Even though you're just starting out, hire a good CPA to help you set up a proper chart of accounts, to teach you what you need to know about operating your accounting system, and whatever methodology you're going to use for software, learn it, know what it means. Take a class or two if you've got the time, and I would say, regardless of whether you have the time or not, take the classes on how to read a P&L, how to understand a balance sheet. I can't tell you how many clients that we meet who can't read their own balance sheets or who understand what's on that balance sheet, present company included when I had my company.
Yeah.
If it weren't for having a good CPA and a good good attorney behind me, I don't know. I think I got where I got to by sheer enthusiasm and that bumblebee effect. So it wasn't because I understood the balance sheet. So definitely setting up a good accounting system. Inventory management from the beginning. If you're going to be a manufacturing facility or distribution facility where you're going to have to maintain tremendous amounts of inventory, make sure that you've got a good system in place. Have it on a computer. Understand what the various reports are that you pull off related to that inventory. keep the inventory moving. Pay attention to what those reports are telling you. How many turns are you getting on the inventory? And then when there is dead inventory, meaning that you might sell it 2 or 3 years from now, get it off the books. Get it off the balance sheet. No buyer is going to want to pay for dead inventory. So pay attention to the inventory piece. Quality controls. Not just in, again, a manufacturing or distribution type business, but even in a service business. Quality controls. Paying attention to how your customers are treated, how they are handled in a complaint situation. Put controls in place so that you know every time there is an issue, there is a solution for it.
So building the value of the reputation at the same time.
That's exactly right.
Excellent.
Establishing HR procedures so that there is some kind of record of what's happening, what is supposed to be, what's not supposed to be, and there are all sorts of classes that you can take for learning how to learn that piece, how to do that piece. And then I think something that is really important to the growth of a company is establishing incentive plans for the employees themselves so that they contribute to the growth of the company, to improvements on a plant floor, or how money could be saved by implementing certain ideas that they have, and then incentivize them, you know, pay them, reward them in some way for those kinds of contributions.
That's excellent. I guess and brilliant to say do that the day you open your doors, because you're going to benefit from their knowledge right from the get-go.
Well, and it will evolve as the company evolves, but if you've got the platform in place, it's much easier to grow from that platform than it is to try to invent the wheel 10 years into the business.
Yeah. And much of what you covered also will keep them out of legal issues so that you don't have legal issues holding up a sale.
Right.
Absolutely. That's really great. Thanks. That makes so much sense. So our audience is comprised of family-owned businesses. I know that's been a good part of your client base. Can you share some of the situations that have prompted families to sell?
I could give you a list of them almost. There are any number of reasons. The most, I guess, we see, or the ones we see most often, would be the retirement of the owner, an illness that is taking the energy of the owner away from the attention of the business. Sometimes it's a family feud if there are several family members. I have to tell you, we have a number of clients where there are issues with brothers and sisters or children or husband and wife. And it makes it very difficult to continue to keep the momentum going to grow that business when those kinds of tensions exist in the business. Other reasons would be a divorce, a partnership split. That's as bad as a divorce. The family's just not qualified to carry on after the owner, you know, wants to make an exit.
Right.
Sometimes it's the need for a liquidity event. You are in your early 60s, and you realize all of a sudden, wow, I don't have enough money to live on when I retire, and the most of my net worth is tied up in this company, and an owner wants to take the cash off the table and put it in something solid so that they know they're assured of a livelihood going forward. And I think probably the most fun reasons we ever see for a business being sold or wanting to sell, we see serial entrepreneurs, the individuals who are notorious for taking an idea and building a business and keeping it for 3 to 5 years. They set up the systems, they set up the processes, and they have a good customer base. They've got good employees. They put management in place. And all of a sudden, they wake up one day and they're bored with it.
Right.
They're bored with it, and it's time to go do that again. We love those. We actually have a couple of clients that we have sold their business, not the same business, but businesses that they have built multiple times.
Wow. Wow.
And they're great fun.
That's fun. And I'm sure versus the first situation where some would be almost distress sale versus that, I'm sure as we get deeper into this, we'll be able to share things about the valuation of one versus the other or the multiples that can be achieved in one situation versus the other. So, assuming that most people haven't started, and I'm sure I know in my conversations with clients, they are talking about wanting to sell their business in a year, and I ask them how far down the road they are, and they haven't started. So I just kind of, that's when I reach out to folks like you. So once somebody has made that decision, I guess is two part. When should they be thinking about that? If indeed they haven't thought about it in the beginning, is it something they should think about a year or three or five ahead? And then where do they start? Where do they actually begin?
We like to start talking with our clients as early as a year, 2 years, sometimes 3 years out. It gives us an opportunity to be able to go in and assess what the condition of the business is like, what the accounting records are like, what the manufacturing facility, the building itself, what that is like, what the employee base is like, what the customer base is like. If we're dealing with a client who has one or two big boxes as their only customer, then we know that the value is not going to be there for that customer, that for that client, as it would be if there's a diverse customer base. So we want to talk with them about those kinds of things, and they can choose to keep doing what they're doing, but understand that it affects the overall value. In meeting with that client or that potential client, we like to go through a list of things to prepare them for. Again, it's back to like what it is when you first start.
Right.
Take a look at what the inventory situation is like. If there's dead inventory, not only get it out of the building, get it off the books. Clean up the financial records. This would be where that old set of books had been kept, and or maybe there had been two, three, four bookkeepers working on it, and there is no semblance of order to how things are maintained or where the items on the P&L are parked in the chart of accounts. Those are where we find skeletons in a closing situation, and we want them to get those things cleaned up, and they need a good CPA or a good accountant to help them with that.
And that's going to take some time.
It definitely takes time. That financial piece alone, if there are problems with it, could take a year to 2 years to clean up. We want to be able to, when we market a client for selling, we want to be able to give that potential buyer at least 3 good years of financial statements. We can't always do that, but we certainly want to know that there is a benchmark a year, 2 years back where things have been cleaned up. Yes, it's wonderful to have audited financial statements. Very few people have those.
Right.
But that's a place to begin, is starting with the financial piece.
I would think that for a buyer looking at a business, the cleaner the financials, the more they assume the rest of it. It says something about the whole rest of the deal.
It absolutely does.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, and the more data that is available, the better the record keeping, the better it makes the buyer feel about that company. Because as you said, hey, if the books are clean, maybe the warehouse is clean. Maybe the inventory is clean. Maybe the employees are the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly sets the tone. Anything else along those lines?
Yes, you want to look at the employee base. And we see this oftentimes in family-owned businesses where there are family members on the payroll. Sometimes they are overpaid. And that's not a problem because we will add back in a cash flow situation, we will add back that overage. But if you've got people on the payroll that are underperforming in your warehouse, in your office, in your plant, get rid of them. Drop that money to the bottom line. Let it be the health of the company. Oftentimes in family-owned businesses, the heart gets to be so big that they can't let people go when they really need to.
Right.
And you don't like to think about that, but it's a necessity if you're going to survive, and it's certainly a necessity if you're going to get value out of the business. The other thing that we have seen more in the past 8 to 10 years, obsolete websites that were set up 7, 8 years ago, and they look the same today as they did when they were set up. Unfortunately, that's an expensive piece, unless you've got someone who is clever enough to keep it updated yourself. But it really is one that is it's the image of the company. And if the website is old, again, it's the perception. The website's old. Maybe the employees aren't working to their best. Maybe the inventory's old. It's another piece to examine.
That's interesting. So they've got two footprints. They've got their physical footprint, but they also have a digital footprint.
That's
now.
That's true.
And it may be website, and as it goes forward, there may even be things out there that are tidbits that they didn't, that are somebody else has posted about them on social media, about their business. So they have to kind of ferret all that out. That's part of their reputation building, isn't it?
It is. Absolutely is.
Very interesting. Had never thought about that. That's great. I think this idea of books and records is probably, as you have said, it's so critical. And my observation that it's essential, I think it'd be great to drill down a little bit further on that. Can you talk about some of the things and maybe some of the instances that you've seen specifically where things were in great shape and what it meant and things weren't in great shape and what it meant?
Well, in preparing to sell, we've talked some about eliminating the items that distract from the value. Let's talk about the items that we can add that would add to the value, and that would be, yes, talking about books and records, getting them in order, getting them clean. Most people, when they start a company, the attorney will throw a corporate book at them, and that's the last time that book is opened until they're at a closing table. And there may be blank stock certificates in it. There may be blank minutes because nobody ever thought to post those on an annual basis. And particularly if you're going to look at a stock transaction, that's got to be brought up to date. You may as well do it every year. It's minimal. You can learn to do it yourself. Get your corporate book in order. Look at the Secretary of State's website. How are you posted with them? You got to file an annual registration fee anyway. Go look at that site every year and see if, in fact, the information that's available with the state is, in fact, what is true today in your organization, in your corporation. And what we have seen there would be there's been a divorce. The wife is still on the corporate site as an officer of the company, or there was an employee who was an officer who is no longer with the business. Clean that stuff up. It's very easy to do. It's really a matter of going into these kinds of places and taking a look at what's there and getting it current. Mm. Mm. Taxes. We oftentimes see tax returns that are postponed being filed for up to 6-9 months sometimes, to the point that there are penalties involved with them. That doesn't help you at all when you're getting ready to sell. And along with the tax return, you want to make sure that the financial statements that you are using that support those tax returns match.
Ah.
That is a key. Now, granted, there will be adjustments that an accountant will make to the tax return that will sometimes pull differences between the two. But that can be explained if it's been done by an accountant. If it's because of poor reporting, poor accounting records, that there is a difference, then we got big trouble. Because particularly if a buyer is going to want to use any kind of institutional financing to get a deal done, they're going to want to see those tax returns. And they will actually have you sign permits that allow them to go to the IRS office and look at the tax returns, make sure that they were, in fact, not that you've just got copies of them, but that they were, in fact, filed. So it's very important that you look at your tax returns, look at your financial statements, talk to your accountant. Okay, I see that there's a difference. Explain to me why there's a difference in the two. And if you can understand it, or at least know that he or she understands it, then you're okay there. But to be oblivious and trust without knowing the answer is very dangerous.
Yeah, it's very interesting because what I hear, I think of many of my clients get so caught up in the day-to-day, so busy with the day-to-day, that some of the things that you're talking about, they consider just detail work. And in fact, their business in the day-to-day basis for that 12 to 18 months could function fine without those details being taken care of. But again, if you're thinking from the beginning about selling the business, then it makes you more conscious of why, even though it's not going to change what's going to happen tomorrow, and tomorrow you're worried about getting an inventory shipped, it makes you stop and realize that that's costing you just as much as the lack of turns in inventory.
Well, and I think for most of our clients, most of our sellers, they absolutely don't want to take the time to go back and do that. That's detail work that they can back burner. Mm-hmm. It's not prudent to do that, because over time, if there is an error there, it could be compounding. And we've seen that happen, such as one client close to 8 to 10 years ago changed computer systems. And when they did, everything was brought from the old system. And this is a company that had several million dollars in inventory. As they transitioned the old information onto the new, there was no physical inventory completed at the time that change was made. So they took an error from the past, transported it into the new, and it sat there. It sat there all those years. Every year-end adjustment was made to bad information. A couple of years ago, as they started to think about getting ready to sell, they decided that they would start having their financial statements audited, which is a very, very good thing to do if you can afford to do it. The auditors, in going back and trying to find that benchmark, discovered what had happened. And for it to go back that far, I'm really surprised they even caught it. But it was, and they had to do about a $700,000 write-down in 1 year. Now, that can be devastating to the bottom line.
Absolutely.
So if you watch it all along, if you check it every year, if you know the information that's coming to you in these reports, if you believe it and you believe the people who are providing you with that information, then at least you're not going to be blindsided when it hits you years down the road.
Absolutely. You know, we've talked about cleaning up the books. Once you get all of those, that part of your house in order, anything else that we should be looking at before they think about getting that business out to market?
Well, a couple more items on the books and records, too. And that has to do with the chart of accounts, making sure that your chart of accounts is in order, and making sure that whoever is doing the posting for the accountant or for the bookkeeper, so that when the P&Ls are produced, that items are getting charged into the proper line items. That's particularly important if a buyer is going to be looking at cost of goods and trying to look at margins. Buyers are more savvy today than they have ever been, and certainly the strategic and financial buyers are more savvy than they've ever been. And they'll look at margins and what the rules of thumb for that particular industry will be across the nation. And if you're out of line, then red flags go up. And it could be something as simple as the bookkeeper not having the knowledge about why it's important to be sure and charge the right item to the right account. So, again, there should be a review on an annual basis of everything going in there. As an owner, you're going to have some idea in your head about what is right and what is wrong. Did I really spend $50,000 this year on travel and entertainment? No, I didn't. Why is it all stuck in there? Ask those questions of yourself. The other thing is again, making sure that everything's been properly recorded to the appropriate account, and moving out of the books and records, there's a different kind of housekeeping or house cleaning that needs to take place, and that's the physical condition, the physical appearance of the office. It's all about perception. If you walk into an office and the walls are dirty and the carpet stained with grease and coffee stains, the desks are piled high with old papers, and you can see yuck, but ashtrays or something like that sitting around on the desk, and empty Coke bottles and boxes in the corners, what kind of impression do you think that makes? It's exactly like selling a house when you look at what the physical appearance is. You walk down the halls and into the bathrooms. You know, as a homeowner, if I'm going to buy a house, the two places I'm going to look first are the kitchen and the bathrooms. If they're not clean, I've got to assume that the rest of the house has not been maintained either. You continue on down the hallway, you open the door into the warehouse, and there's stuff all over the floors. There are boxes that have not been put up on the racking. There's old equipment that's sitting with so much dust on it, you wonder how old it is. That does not leave a good impression at all. You got to go through a spring cleaning, and you really ought to do it about once a quarter. If your employees are accustomed to seeing it happen on a periodic basis, then there is no concern on their part when all of a sudden you've got guests coming in,
right,
and the business looks like it does.
Right.
Paint the walls. If it needs a little paint, that is one of the least expensive things that you can do to improve the appearance of a business. Get rid of the excess furniture. We see clients who still have the first desk that they started with 20 years ago just because they may need it one day. You know, we can put it in a copy room someplace. We can put it in a closet someplace, but it just clutters up the appearance of everything. Get the carpets clean. That's another inexpensive thing you can do.
So we got the books cleaned. We've got the house clean, and I think, what you shared is great because sometimes people are starting to get things spruced up and they don't want to alarm their employees until they're ready to kind of tell them. So a lot of the things that you're saying, if you've just been doing this all along, then it doesn't look like something unusual is going on. So that's excellent. Is there any... your firm is out helping them kind of market the business. Is there anything that they can do from their side leading up to and particularly around the time that they've decided to make this sale that will enable you to do an even better job of getting the word out?
Boy, that's a great question. Nothing makes us happier. Nothing makes the buyer happier than to walk into a business and see displays of achievements that company has earned, that its employees have earned, that its design has earned over a period of recent time. I'll give you an example of a client we worked with a few years ago, and this gentleman really thought his business was the best thing since hotcakes. And we walked down the hallways, and there were all kinds of framed points of accomplishment for the company. Nothing was newer than 5 or 6 years old.
Wow.
So he was really good back then. What has he done since then? Tell me how good you are today. The buyer's not going to buy what happened 10 years ago, 6 years ago, 5 years ago. They want to know what you're doing now. So get yourself out there before, you know, whether it's getting on websites and trying to find places where you can showcase your company, showcase your employees, get your picture out there, get your brand out there, get your company before the public so that a buyer can see, hey, this is a known commodity. I think part of that is also cleaning up the website and getting new information on the website. Make sure that it is constantly maintained and that what you are promoting is, in fact, still true. Another good example, we've had clients with obsolete websites where there were products shown on their website that they hadn't carried in years.
Mm.
And that just is not a good thing.
Well, it's neglect all the way around.
It is,
and that is something. And the other thing that I, as I'm listening to you, I think that from start to finish, the dream of every business owner is that when they decide to sell, that it will go pretty smoothly. and we know that that's not actually the way it's going to happen. But what you're sharing with me tells me that if they do some of these little things along the way, it's not just that it will move smoothly, but that the buyer won't be digging into the knickers as deeply. And that's not to say that you're not selling a great and a sound business. I'm not indicating that, but that, you know, there's no reason to be suspect.
It helps take the doubt away.
Exactly. And you're not spending days or months doing due diligence just because of where nothing is found, but that was caused to happen because of these little minor things that are just so it's just so easy to do.
Well, one of the things that I was going to talk about a little later on is finding skeletons in the closet, because it's very important that when we work with a client mm-hmm. that we know everything we possibly can about that company, about lawsuits that have occurred in the past, or maybe even there's still pending lawsuits out there. They have a way of forgetting
right.
to tell us about that, or
right.
forgetting to tell the buyer about that. And then you're in due diligence, and all of a sudden the skeleton opens the closet door and comes out dangling. And that's not the time to resolve the issues. We see that in payroll taxes that have not been paid, or it could be any number of things. I could give you a list of 100 long if I just thought about all the various scenarios, but the skeletons don't help anybody.
Right.
And they can be something very little to that seller, but be monumental. I think about one that occurred recently where we were working a buy-side engagement. And we were negotiating about a $32, $35 million deal. And we learned that there was an option to purchase.
Oh, my.
We also learned that it was very possible that the owner of that company was using our client, the buyer, as leverage to get the ante up on the option.
Oh, my.
So needless to say, the buyer pulled away from that very, very quickly. Those games,
they don't work.
They don't work.
So
they don't work.
You've been doing this for 19 years. Have you ever seen a skeleton not fall out of the closet eventually?
I've seen a lot of deals that were better than others. Usually there is something
right.
that will end up, and due diligence is, I tell our clients that it's like opening your lingerie drawers
right.
and exposing everything about yourself to a perfect stranger.
Right.
Emotions are high during those times on both sides, particularly when you think about on the sell side, giving up that baby that they nurtured, that they grew. On the buy side, I'm about to pay you X number of dollars for this business, and you want me to do what? There are emotions really, really strong on both sides. And when you get down to the final hours before a deal closes and documents are flying back and forth and the lawyers have gotten involved at this stage and the accountants have gotten involved at this stage and landlords and vendors and anybody else who can step into the picture to put a wrinkle in things, you can see the looks on their faces, and you know that the stress is so high, you wonder how in the world you're ever going to get the deal to the table. The most beautiful thing about that is if the seller really wants to sell and that buyer really wants to buy, if they can stay focused on that piece, we can get through. We can help them get through all those other things, and they will be there.
Right.
There's no deal that's ever done that doesn't have a wrinkle or two, and some have more than others.
Just like us.
Mm-hmm.
So last week our guest talked as part about his work as a CPA, bringing in a group of trusted advisors for his clients. And as I listen to you, it certainly sounds like a team is needed. Maybe the same team, parts of the same team that they've been using, maybe different team members than they've been using, and a broader base of trusted advisors. Can you talk a little bit about what should that team look like?
Yes, Pat, and what I would start that with is you really want to have the right professionals surrounding you when you are ready to sell a company or to buy a company. And those individuals may be different than the ones you normally have throughout the course of operating that company. When you start writing contracts and letters of intent and preparing closing documents and lease agreements and all those kinds of things that go along with getting a deal closed, you really need a transactional attorney working on those. The worst possible person you could have from a legal standpoint would be a litigator. You would never, get a document that would be acceptable to both parties.
Yeah.
Litigators are great. They are great to do what they have to do, but they're not transactional people. And so you want to make sure that your team includes a transactional attorney. The other thing that I like to tell people, and this is what you think about from the very beginning, too, when you start the company. If you don't do it then certainly do it when you get to thinking about selling the business. And that is that you make sure that your lawyer, that your accountant, and any other professional advisor, financial person, whoever you may have who's involved in that decision-making, you make sure they're on the same page with you, that they understand, okay, here is my intention. It's time for me to sell my ABC company. I need your assistance. I need your advice. I need your counsel. And I want you to protect me, but I want you to help me get the deal done. Because, and I say that, because there have been many, many occasions when we have seen deals fall apart for several simple and emotional reasons. One, a CPA firm who's been able to collect $40,000 or $50,000 a year in accounting fees from a company. All of a sudden, they discover their number one, their number two client may go away, and that the new party buying that business may not use them, right. may not keep that business going. So how would you feel if you were going to lose that amount of money coming into your firm? We've seen CPA firms kill deals by dragging their feet, by not helping the client get the information, the proper information, to the buyer so that they can fully assess the business. And that is so, so sad. No one would ever admit to that. And it happens, and it's so subtle that maybe the people don't understand it themselves.
Right.
It puts everyone in a difficult situation when you realize that that's what's happening, because it's hard for us to have that seller understand, wow, I've got an advisor who's not playing on my team.
Wow.
They're on their own team, and they're not playing to my advantage.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the law side is concerned, I think, again, having the transactional person who understands those kinds of documentation as opposed to whether they're an estate attorney or litigators and civil practice, those kinds of things, you just are better off with a transactional person. I also feel, particularly if you've got a business that you've been running for a number of years and you're actively involved in it, you should hire an intermediary or a consultant who can come in and help you prepare the business for sale, help you prepare the marketing package, help you find the right buyer for that business, and allow you to keep running the company the way you've been running it. A seller doesn't need, number one, to be negotiating for themselves. They really are in a bad place when they're the ones who have to negotiate price or terms. They really don't have the bargaining power, and they're too emotional to be able to negotiate and put all the pieces together.
Sure. It reminds me, you talked about this is their baby, so there's nothing more emotional than if you're talking about the child.
That's right.
Yeah.
And giving it up for adoption.
Exactly.
Particularly when you've lived in it as long
exactly.
as you have. Most people put all of their net worth into a company, and when you think about the risk that's involved in giving that up, it's a very scary time.
Exactly. You know, I recently spoke with a family business owner he and his brother owned a business, and they sold it. And when I asked them, the deal went very quickly, and they got the multiples that they wanted and then some. And I asked them one of the secrets. And it goes back to something you were talking about earlier, which was about the accounting systems that were switched over. And they highlighted the fact that it was because one of the brothers was a technology genius, even though the business was a good old non-technology. And one was really into technology. And therefore, there were no legacy issues in the systems, et cetera. Have you seen that That's not an advisor that maybe before the days of technology taking over a business, that advisor was never necessarily at the table or brought in. But do you see a role then for a technical consultant to come in and look at those systems and maybe have found that $700,000 error, someone to look at it, not just from the accounting bookkeeper technology, but all of the systems within the company to make sure that they are talking and going to be able to continue to build value.
It's interesting that you point that out. My experience over the recent years has been that if a company uses technology in its operation, those who are committed to using technology generally keep themselves up to date and have a firm representing them who can come in and handle network problems or handle website problems, and they would understand enough about the bookkeeping software that would be used that they can also help them with inventory or the bookkeeping or the accounting side of piece. But if they've not been involved in technology, oftentimes it is such a scary thing for them that they don't have it at all. And so you see more archaic methods used to run that company. Mm-hmm. Rarely do I see a company where the technology is being used and it just, yeah, lots of them need advancing, but a lot of them don't want to spend the money right to do that. And then who do you trust? Because if I'm selling a telephone system, then I'm going to sell my telephone system. I'm not going to sell somebody else's just because it's less expensive. So that's a good question. Mm. Very good question.
It may be something going forward. I think the technology is just so much an underpinning, even though...
More today than ever.
Exactly. And even though people were in the past able to stave off, as you said, and keep it on a paper system and not, they can no longer, mostly because if they're selling to anybody larger than a small company, that larger company is going to insist upon some kind of sophistication in that area as well.
Well, and it also is an advantage for buyers look at that if... unless it's just dead. Buyers look at that as an opportunity to be able to streamline things and possibly, cut out an employee or two by making things more electronically safe and sound.
Exactly. I know we already touched upon the skeletons, and I just have this sense as I've talked to clients that one of the things they do worry most about, they maybe have had it happen in their personal life that they've tried to sell a house and it didn't sell at the last minute. We've talked about the skeleton issues and some of those things. Anything else that can make a deal fall apart at the last minute that people could be thinking about ahead of time?
There are a lot of things that could make a deal fall apart at the last minute. And there are a lot of things that could make it healthier along. And I think part of that is if a seller wants to get the greatest value for the business and has done a good job cleaning up the records, cleaning up the physical facility, it wouldn't hurt for them to go through a trial run of what due diligence would be like. They get a little of that when we come into the picture anyway, because we will ask them for equipment lists. We'll ask them for current inventory numbers. We'll ask them for 3 to 5 years of financial statements. And we'll start to spot those kinds of areas where we think they need to pay attention. However, we're not going to get into the lingerie drawer like the buyer will. So it's important for that seller to put himself into a buyer's shoes and to just start examining the company with a different look, a different view than from that sales seat. So I think if they can put themselves through their own due diligence cycle, they'll learn a lot, particularly if they're open-minded enough to see, wow, I never dreamed that this would be an issue. We can help them a little bit with that, but a lot of it they have to do themselves.
Yeah, even just a dry run.
It's like a dry run.
You touched on something about the trusted advisors being on the same page, and I want to revisit that for a second, because one of the things when I go in to do a recruiting assignment, I want to make sure that the family is on the same page together in the room about the need for that position and the person that we're bringing on, et cetera. Talk a little bit, if you could, about that family being on the same page, just like the trusted advisors being on the same page, I would have to think that that can accelerate or delay things dramatically.
Boy, you hit the nail on the head with that. When we're in meetings with sellers, we like to meet with all the parties. We don't always get to do that. Sometimes what we learn is that partners are at odds with one another, and it'll take a comment or two for us to realize, uh-oh, there is a feud brewing here underneath the surface. And oftentimes when that kind of thing happens, it's because one of them is getting something more than the other and doesn't want to sell. But the partner who is being deprived is the one who wants to liquidate and get the heck out of Dodge and take his chips off the table, so to speak, because he's being used in the relationship. That goes back to having buy-sell agreements in the beginning. If you've got a partnership arrangement, you generally won't have that in a family situation, but you probably should. Okay. Certainly if there's stock ownership among the family members, there should be buy-sell agreements and fail-safe so that if this happens, then such and such will happen. But those are the kinds of things that we see. We have family situations where there's one active member and other brothers and sisters or parents are receiving paychecks every month, and they are very critical of the partner, or the not the partner, but the family member who is running the company.
Right.
And yet they have no clue what's happening
right.
in it. Mm. I feel for those sellers. I feel for those people when they have to go through that, because mm-hmm. on the one hand, they're trying to run a business. On the other, they're trying to keep a family together. And a lot of times that's why they sell, is because, do I give up my company? Do I give up my family?
Absolutely. And my experience is that the company will always go first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Be put aside first, I should say that. You know, we have a few minutes. I'm going to ask you for some tips in a minute. But there's a topic that you and I have talked about casually, and it's kind of interesting to me, kind of along the lines of you talked earlier about a motivated buyer and a motivated seller. And I've had some experience with a business owner not being highly motivated, and my sensation sometimes is that they don't know what their next thing is to be. So they're letting go of one end of a trapeze before they know what the other end of the trapeze is. And in some instances, it is getting on the yacht and sailing out to sea. But in other instances, it's that they have to sell this business for one reason or another, or they choose to. Have you worked with clients, or do you, maybe even a better way to ask it is, is it more successful when that business owner has decided what their next thing is going to be? Does that help accelerate and make the process that much better? And is there a way to just convey to our audience the importance of that piece of it?
The answer to that is yes.
Mm-hmm.
It is much easier to work with a client who knows what the next phase of their life is going to include. It is much easier if they have already decided, when I'm done with this, I'm going to go start another company that's totally different from this, or I'm going to take some invention that I've always wanted to work with and I'm going to go exploit it. It is so much easier. Or maybe it's time to go sit under the palm tree. But you're absolutely right. It is hard for us to work with an owner who doesn't know. And quite frankly, if something's going to fall apart, we see that happen in the 10th, 11th, 12th hour, because all of a sudden the seller wakes up and says, what am I going to do tomorrow when my company is gone?
Right.
And we tend to look for that very early on, because we want to know that there is another chapter that's about to start mm-hmm. in that owner's life, even if it's just retirement.
Mm-hmm.
We want to know that that is already in play and that he sees himself on the beach in order to take them on.
Right. So maybe another trusted advisor to bring to that table is that kind of your next, you know, there's a wonderful company here in Atlanta called Your Sabbatical, which tells people how to let go and take off for a short period of time, and maybe getting somebody involved that can consult with that owner on
great idea.
Starting to develop their next picture. Huh?
Great idea.
Yeah. This has been great. I'm going to ask you for some tips in a minute, but I had some takeaways that were magnificent, and I hope our audience did too. And a lot of that had to do with over and over again when I heard your comments and your advice, a lot of it was certainly common sense, but more importantly, there was an underlying theme of know your business intimately, take responsibility, hire good people, but know what they're doing. So you have your CPA and you have your attorney, you have your financial advisor, but you know it as almost as well as they do. And that's probably not something many of us who have our own businesses want somebody to take that off our plate, which I heard you say do that, but make sure you know what's on that, what they're up to.
The ultimate goal for a business to be ready to sell is for that owner to be dispensable.
Right.
The more dispensable they are, the better the value again. Yet, if an owner is not active, if an owner is not working on the business so that they know what's happening and they're having people report to them with what's happening in this sales territory, what's happening in the warehouse, or what's happening out here in the marketplace, and which new clients are you bringing on, pretty soon the seller just becomes lethargic and loses control of the company. And believe me, value goes fast when that happens.
Yeah.
So it is important for an owner to raise themselves to a level that they've got excellent management in place that are doing the things they need to do, but that they remain in an oversight position.
Excellent.
Don't lose sight of that. It's too important. It's your, not only is it your baby, it's your livelihood.
Right. It's your legacy as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's really excellent. It's just been it's really great. It's clear that you have a good handle and some absolutely great advice. Anybody who has their business, even if right now they don't think they are ever going to sell and that the children are going to come along and want to grow this generation after generation, at some point in time, everything that you have brought up needs to be thought about and could only improve the value of a business, whether it ever is a transaction for liquidity or not. One of the things that, Sarah, we like to do is ask our guests to provide kind of three tips. We're building a tip library for our audience on our site. And so I wonder what words of wisdom you could finish up with today.
I'm happy to kind of highlight those three points that I think are very important. One, and first and foremost, is plan from the beginning that you're going to sell the company one day or you're going to exit it one day, and work the plan. Plan from the beginning and work the plan. The second thing, and it's something you and I just talked about, stay present with the business. Even though you are out of the day-to-day operation, out of the day-to-day management, you remain that oversight, you stay current with what's happening in the marketplace, in your industry. You can, mental vacations are just the cause of great damage sometimes. So even when a business is finely tuned, stay abreast, stay present with it. The third, I would always say, is making sure that you've got the right team of professional advisors surrounding you. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for a seller to go through this process and to be successful and to get the best value for the business without having a team of good advisors surrounding them. They know what they know very, very well. There's nobody who can make a better widget than that seller, that owner. But they don't always know about the legal side. They don't always know about the accounting. They don't always know about how to negotiate to get the best price or what they're going to do with that windfall when they finally do sell. They need to surround themselves with good, trusted advisors.
Excellent. Three great tips to add to our library. And Sarah, if anybody wants to follow up with you and talk with you and utilize your services, how can they reach you?
Gosh, I'd love to hear from anybody who would love to use our services. I can be reached at Walden Businesses, and that telephone number is 678-277-9951. And I would encourage you to go to our websites if you want to know more about the services and the kinds of clients that we represent. www.waldenbus.com, and our small market group is called waldensmallmarketgroup.com. I also can be reached via email sb@waldenbus.com, And I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Excellent. And for those of you listening, you can also go to our website, our radio website, www.familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com. Sarah's information is up there. And in the next few days, we will be posting this podcast. And we invite you to go there and you can download it. And it will be always available on there as a resource. So thank you very much again.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And I just want to highlight for next week, Thursday, March 4th, Meredith Moore will be back as my sidekick. So I won't be flying solo. And our topic will be, so you build your company. Now, how do you build your wealth? And we're featuring three women who help their family business clients do that every day. We'll have Christina Napoli of First Citizens Bank, Lorraine DeSalvo, who's an estate planning attorney with Morgan DeSalvo, and Anita Pittman, a tax specialist with the regional firm of Cherry, Beckert, and Holland. So I hope you will tune in, and I thank you very much for listening to Family Business Radio this week.